Welcome to Urban Dharma, the podcast, where suffering is optional. Hi, this is Reverend Kusala coming to you from downtown Los Angeles, from the International Buddhist Meditation Center, on a cool and overcast morning in the heart of Koreatown. Yesterday I had the privilege and good fortune of being invited to speak at Chadwick School, and I spoke to four different classes yesterday. The podcast you're about to hear now is the second class I spoke to, and they were reading the book Siddhartha and needed to do an essay on that. The teacher invited me to speak to the class to give them perhaps a better understanding of what Buddhism was all about. So what you're about to hear is that presentation, which turns out to be mostly questions and answers. A lot of really good questions, and I hope some good answers as well. So without further introduction, my presentation at Chadwick School. So I was talking with your teacher earlier and about this essay that you guys are doing. And it's really a difficult one because it's going to challenge you to look at life a little differently. And Buddhism does that for me as well. But let me tell you about one of my favorite books and a story about that book. And maybe it will help you understand more about the essay that you have to do. So one of my favorite books is called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And one of the reasons for that is because I do have a motorcycle, and I do a lot of the maintenance on it myself. But he was also a teacher in this book, and he had a class. And one of the essays he gave his class was, I want you to write about quality. Now, we all know what things have quality and what things don't have quality. But I want you to write about the quality of the thing. Where does it live? What does it look like? And none of the students could hand in the essay. They couldn't figure out where the quality existed, though they all knew it. Now, because Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance had to do with motorcycles, this is what I imagine could have happened if the author of that book had been me, that the two primary characters took their motorcycles to a Kmart parking lot. Now, one guy had a Honda and one guy had a BMW, and the guy that had the BMW always thought his motorcycle had more quality because it was engineered by the Germans. So imagine now this really large parking lot, and they take the motorcycles apart into their 10,000 pieces. And you have the Honda over here, and you have the BMW over here. And you give each of them a very powerful magnifying glass, and you say to them, please find me the quality of your motorcycle. In which piece does it reside? And then I imagine them going piece to piece looking for the quality of their motorcycle. And yet somehow, when all the pieces came together and created one, quality seemed to exist. And yet somehow, when the one was made into the many, quality couldn't be found. Now, a Buddhist might say to you, where does your self live? Do you have a self? The Buddha would have said, do you have a soul? And if you think you have a soul, if you think you have a self, where does it exist? Well, some people thought the soul existed behind the pituitary gland. That's where it existed. Some people wanted to weigh the soul and see how much it weighed. And you know how they did that? They would wait for a person to die. And just before they died, they'd weigh the body. And then after the person died, they'd weigh the body again. And the difference between the weight of the living and the unliving would be how much the soul weighed. Isn't that odd? If you were to look right now for your soul, you would probably come up empty-handed in the same way those guys with the magnifying glasses couldn't find the quality of the motorcycle. If you were asked, where does your self exist? In which part does self live? Are you that self? Is that self unchanging? and independent? Does that self have a unique quality? And if so, why? You would be hard-pressed, even if you were philosophy majors, to define who you really are if self was the model. In Buddhism, we say we are not self. We don't say there isn't a self. Yes. Have I stimulated a question?
You know how you're talking about where would you find self?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a self as a tangible thing that you can see or even weigh.
Okay.
I think of it as more as a thing that's developed and that is changing.
Uh-huh.
And I think everyone does have a different self.
Okay.
You're not necessarily yourself.
Okay. Can I add some words to that to make it more clear for you? Could you say that maybe self is a process and not an event?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just helping you out. Because I had to think about that myself one time. So self is a process. Okay. So where does that process exist? Well, it exists everywhere, doesn't it? Is that process conditional? Does that process need certain conditions to exist? Now you have to say, well, yeah. Because if I didn't have a body, I wouldn't have a self. Huh? If I didn't have a mind, I wouldn't have a self. So two of the conditions we know for sure are body and mind. That those are two of the conditions that create self. Now, has anybody heard of the creation stories? You know, I was fascinated when I first heard about some of these ancient creation stories. And the stories were, it was all dark and then lightness came. It went from darkness to lightness. And a lot of people look at that as being us. We came out of the darkness and came into the lightness. But you know, when I read those stories, and they're in every major and minor civilization, you know what that reminded me of? That reminded me of self. That was the transformation of self from the darkness to the light. You know what I thought about for a long time? I wonder who the first person was that became aware of themselves in the way we are aware of ourselves. Who was that first person that became self-aware? Now, did anybody see The Matrix? Matrix, okay. It was a cool movie, wasn't it? I really liked that movie. And, you know, it was like about getting unplugged and sort of waking up to a whole new reality. Because all those people were asleep. They were like batteries. And all the energy coming from all those human beings who were asleep sort of fed the robots and stuff. Man. But a couple people had woken up, didn't they? And then they had a totally different reality. Well, can you imagine, if you understand or believe or find evolution interesting, that at one point, as human beings, we were probably like the dogs and the cats. We were living intuitively in the present moment, and we didn't know how to think in the way we think now. We didn't know there was a beginning or an end. It was just happening every day in this giant process. And if we were hungry, we'd try to find food, and if we were tired, we'd take a nap. I know the cat I take care of takes a nap all the time. And that was sort of it. We didn't have to go to school. Cats and dogs don't go to school. You know, they just deal with what's real for them. Now, can you imagine if we were like that, like a Neanderthal or something, or even before that, and then one day we were out hunting and something happened and our consciousness shifted and we became self-aware. Can you imagine how that first person must have felt? And now they go over to this like pond with still water, almost mirror-like, and they look into the water and they see themselves in a brand new way. They have become separate from the world around them. They are no longer connected in that primordial way we were when we were very small children. And I thought to myself, I wonder if each one of us is like a model of evolution, that we're born and we don't know where we are. When we're first here, we don't even know who our mother is. and we cry, and the universe feeds us. Oh, gosh, isn't that so cool? And our body feels uncomfortable, and the universe changes us. And we don't even know why or how. And then all of a sudden, at some point, we recognize our hand. Where did that hand come from? Is it connected to me? Who am I? And who's that person in my life called Mom who's always there to help me? Where did she come from? That awareness starts to grow and grow, and we start to become more and more separate from the world around us. And then our parents take us to school, and they want us to learn to read and write. And if you have a vocabulary of 10,000 words, you are separate from the world around you in 10,000 different ways. And you go, oh man, it is so scary to be separate from this world in 10,000 ways. And now they want me to do mathematics too, so I can be separate in a new and unique way. And everything I learn and everything I know keeps me separate from everything I want to be a part of. Wow. So for Buddhists, our first truth is that life is basically unsatisfactory because we're separate. And we have this underlying fear and anxiety because of that separateness. And the Buddha said, I want to teach you how to reconnect again to the world around you. But you'll never be able to reconnect like you were when you were young, because you reconnected in that way because you were ignorant. You see? But now you know all this stuff, and you can't forget it. You can't forget everything you know to go back to being one with everything. So what you have to do now is you have to transcend all the stuff you know. Doesn't mean you forget it. It means you see how it's not you. Everything you know, every experience you've ever had, is not you. In Buddhism, in the Zen tradition, they have a koan, a question that can't be answered with the intellect. What was your original face before you were born? And you would sit in meditation and you'd say to yourself, what was my original face before I was born? Did I even have a face before I was born? And you might say to yourself, gosh, I wasn't here for a really long time. And now I've been here for 15, 16, 20, 30 years. But who was I before I was born? And who will I be after I'm gone? And who am I now? And why is life so confusing?
So if you aren't all the things that you learn and you think, then what are you?
Yes. Thank you. If you aren't all the things you have learned and done, then who are you really? Ultimately, what is your ultimate truth? Now, I can only speak from a Buddhist perspective, so I'll tell you what the ultimate truth is from a Buddhist perspective. The ultimate truth is this. You are really, always have been, always will be, interconnected and interdependent to all things. The illusion of being separate is just that. It is an illusion. None of us are ever separate. We are all brothers and sisters forever. We don't know it, though. As we wake up, according to Buddhism, as we become enlightened, like Siddhartha, we start to see that, yes, in fact, I am interconnected and interdependent. That self that I thought was separate is simply a process. It gives me the illusion of being separate, but ultimately I am interconnected and interdependent. There is a very big price to pay when that happens in your life. That is called the enlightenment experience. And if that were to happen to any one of you, you could never be the person you are now, ever again. You would see a homeless person, and you would say, that's me. I'm homeless in that way. How can I find them shelter? I need to find shelter for them because they're me and I'm them, and I need shelter too. And if you see a person who's hungry, and you say, I'm hungry now Because I'm connected to everyone and everything all the time. And if there's one person in this world that's hungry, that means there's a part of me that's hungry now, too. And if there's one person dying in this world, that means there's a part of you dying now. How can I make them comfortable in their transition while they're dying? Because that's me dying. Every time someone dies, a part of me dies. Every time someone is homeless, there's a part of me that's homeless. That's what happens when you become enlightened. If you've heard of this term, the Bodhisattva is a Buddhist saint. The Bodhisattva is someone who's woken up to that ultimate reality of interconnection and interdependent, and their job, their only job now, is to be of service to others, because they are the others. They realize that through their enlightenment experience. Yes.
So, like, the opposites don't balance it out. Like, so the person who's really full, if there's someone who's really full,
yeah,
you balance out the person who's really hungry.
No. Wouldn't that be nice if it did?
So you just feel like one is opposed to the other.
You feel both. Exactly. So there's a part of you that's really full, but there's a part of you that's really empty at exactly the same time. That's the hard part to understand. All this stuff is happening at exactly the same time. So can we really have a tall and small if they happen at exactly the same time? Or is it something different? Yeah. Good question. Thank you.
What is it about, according to Buddhism, that makes everyone interconnected? Like, how is it that we're brothers and sisters and all?
How is it that...
If you're hungry, how am I hungry?
Yeah. Remember I talked earlier about that moment that we woke up? We were sort of like in this primordial haze, and that first person sort of woke up and became separate. Our language allows us to be separate. Our mind, our intellect, our ego creates the separateness for us. It's very powerful, our ego. It's our reality. Our ego writes the story of our life every day, every moment of every day. But what's behind the ego? Is it simply a process, like we talked about? Or is it real? And if it's not real and it's only a process, then what's the basis for that? And the basis for that separateness is connectedness. But not oneness. Now, does anybody know the difference between one and many? Well, let me tell you, because I phrase that in sort of a strange way. A lot of us think one is the best number. Now, I'm old. I was in the 60s, and one, for us, was the loneliest number that you ever heard. But when you look at the world, everybody seems to think one is the best. We all want, like, one world bank, one nation under one God. If we can become the one, we will have reached our perfection. But you know what I hear when people say, I want to be the one? I hear and see all the ones that are left out. Where do we put those ones? Well, sometimes if you're not the one, they have to get rid of you. That doesn't sound very fair, does it? Is one really the best number? Or perhaps is the ultimate reality of life the interconnectedness and interdependence? Is it the unity? And does that unity allow for diversity? Can we be separate and still be connected to each and every person in the world? And according to unity and diversity, yes, we can. According to oneness, no, we can't. Oneness, for me, defines uniformity. I don't want to be one with everybody. How boring would that be? I want to be who I am. I want to ride a motorcycle. Not everybody wants to ride a motorcycle. So when I go to these interreligious gatherings, and I sometimes talk with other religious people, and they say, Kusla, it's so nice to have you with us. You're one with us today. And I say, oh, no, I'm not. I'm connected to you today. But don't you want to be one with us, Kusla? I say, no, I don't need to be. I'm already connected to you. It's just you can't see that yet. And I got a feeling when Siddhartha was looking at the river. And what is a river? A river is a process. It's never an event. Siddhartha woke up to the fact that he was interconnected and interdependent with all things. He became enlightened in that moment of realization after looking at the way the river flowed. Yes?
You said that everyone's like, if I'm hungry, you're hungry. Well, like, if people are suffering, then you're suffering and you want to stop that. But I don't think you can ever stop people from suffering. That's like impossible because everyone suffers.
And do you know why they suffer?
Because of oneness, maybe? I don't know, but like, I don't think there's any way to stop suffering, though.
Okay, thank you for bringing it up. You don't feel there's any way to stop suffering. I'm going to say you're absolutely right if you haven't heard of Buddhism.
Yeah.
But you know why we're here as Buddhists? What's our goal?
Just to end suffering.
To end suffering.
But there's now, so many people with different opinions and like different feelings about things.
Exactly.
Stop.
Okay, no, it's very difficult. It hasn't worked yet.
Yeah.
But first we have to figure out what suffering is. Where does suffering come from? That's the first thing we have to figure out. Yeah, I'll get to everybody. Okay. I know this is... So, what would a Buddhist say? Suffering comes from birth. We're born. What happens when each one of us were born? We have to get old. What happens because we were born? We have to get sick. What happens because we were born? We have to die. Everything that's born has to die. If that's not bad enough, everything we really love, cherish, and want to hold on to will be taken away from us. And the culprit is impermanence and change. Everything changes. And if you attach to anything the way it is right now, when it changes, you'll be disappointed. When it changes, you will suffer. And if that's not bad enough, there are people in this world that we do not like. And there are places in this world we do not want to be in, and we are around those people and in those places far too often, and there's nothing we can do about it. So when the Buddha looked at the world as being unsatisfactory, he didn't say it was always unsatisfactory. He didn't say it always led to suffering, but he said it was ultimately unsatisfactory. Now let me give you a definition of suffering, because a lot of people aren't clear about what suffering is. The best definition I've ever heard came from a seventh grader. Her name was Esmeralda. I was giving a presentation in her class in Glendale, California, and she listened to my whole presentation, and she said to me, "Kusala, I now understand the difference between pain and suffering. Suffering happens when you don't want to have the pain." How did she know? Suffering happens when you have a Honda and want a Ford. Suffering happens when you don't have a girlfriend and want one. Suffering happens when you have a girlfriend and don't want one. Suffering happens when you want things to be different than they are. In Buddhism, if we want to end suffering, we want to help people come to a place of acceptance with the way things are. If they can accept the perfection of each and every present moment, they will never suffer. So the second truth is we suffer because we're all selfish. Each and every one of us is so selfish. All we want to do every day in every way is to hold on to all the good stuff and push away all the bad stuff. But because we're born with original ignorance, not original sin, we never get it right. Third truth is the end of suffering. We call the end of suffering nirvana. Nirvana is the end of suffering. And then we have something called the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Those eight path factors lead us to nirvana, the end of suffering. So as a Buddhist, we feel there is an end to suffering. If you find a way to accept everything just the way it is, with no preferences, not wanting anything to be different than it is, you will never have to suffer. Sounds pretty difficult, doesn't it? Impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Only a few people do it. The Buddha, Siddhartha, was one of them who did it. And for 45 years, he taught the path to the end of suffering. He shared with us how he ended his suffering.
So there's a difference between pain suffering.
There is a difference between pain and suffering. Pain is not optional. Suffering is. Thank you.
So without like suffering, we're just like accepting everything, so then like nothing's really changing? But is that like okay?
Everything's always changing.
Well, like, let's
but you're accepting the fact that everything always changes. And you're having a great hair day today, and tomorrow it sucks. Well, and you go, it changed. And but
the,
there's
what
a...
What about the boyfriend then? Like,
oh, aren't they the worst?
You're your boyfriend and you always have... And then...
No, it's when you do get rid of your boyfriend, everything becomes perfect. What happens, how many times does your relationship last forever? Have you ever had a relationship that lasted forever? It always changes. And even if you found the perfect guy, and he was your soulmate, and he loved you and you loved him, eventually he would have to leave because he would have to die.
Yeah.
So...
the,
you're accepting the fact that everything is in a constant state of flux and change, just like the river that Siddhartha was watching.
But so, like, how is it? So there's only progress. Like,
there's only process.
You're not doing anything. It's just doing it on its own.
You are always doing something. It is always doing something, and that is the present moment experience of your life. But we never really get to have a direct experience of that because our mind, our intellect, writes this story all the time. Evolve into a separate human being.
So
and then they name you.
The only way you evolve or like grow is by like in your mind. Like you don't do anything. Like in school, like we like study and we like we don't like accept that we like, oh I know what I know. We're like, oh wait, I need to know more.
No, you accept all of that and you're always doing something. But behind all of that doing and accepting is the fact that it's not you doing it. So who's doing it? Where does that process live? Who's in charge?
I don't know.
Yeah, I know. That's the real scary part.
So now we're to study for like a quiz, then we're just like...
Are we ever in charge? You know?
Yeah.
Back in the 80s, I had a brand new car, an Opel Manta. It was flag blue, four on the floor, audio cassette. Okay?
Wow.
Somebody broke into my car and took my audio cassette radio right out. And I went over to my car and I said, car, who owns you? Who's in charge of you? Aren't I making the payments? Don't I wash you? Don't I fill you with gas? Aren't you my car? Car, who owns you? And my car said absolutely nothing back to me. And I had this sudden realization that I didn't really own my car. I was just using it until it broke or was stolen or taken back by the bank. And then I looked in the mirror and I said, who am I? Do I own me? Can I prevent myself from getting old and gray and wrinkled? No. Can I prevent myself from feeling bad? Sometimes you just feel bad. Can I prevent myself from getting sick and dying? No. Why do I think I own myself or own other things? It's because I have this ego that needs to be separate and needs to be in control because that control leads me to believe that I can find security in this world that is always changing and in a constant state of flux. And there is no security out in this world at all. The Buddha called this world samsara. This is where birth and death occur. Right out here all the time. And we're in spring now and everything's blossoming. And isn't it beautiful? The trees are starting to get full again and the flowers are blooming and the colors are out. But then that will go away too. There's no security out here. The Buddha said the only perfection we'll ever find in this imperfect world is in our heart. That's where our perfection exists, right inside. So as a Buddhist, we stop looking out there for our salvation, our security, and we start looking in here. This is our refuge. Isn't that cool? Yes.
This is sort of a personal one. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but have you been enlightened?
That's a great question. I have not been enlightened. I hope to one day.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's difficult. And I keep getting distracted. I get invited to go give talks and stuff. I should be meditating right now. You know? Thanks for the question. Yeah?
What is between you and getting enlightened? Like,
what have you yet? Yes, what is in between me and enlightenment? What a great question. Thank you. I will tell you. There are four things right now that stand between me and enlightenment. The first one is lust. Difficult. Second one is greed. Very difficult. Third one is hatred and anger. Almost the most difficult. And the fourth one is delusion and ignorance. So I need to change my lust into love. I need to change my greed into generosity. I need to change my hatred and anger into loving kindness and compassion. I need to change my delusion and ignorance into wisdom. When I do that, when I succeed, I will have achieved enlightenment. Very difficult. Yes?
Okay. So, I might be wrong about this, but so in Buddhism, those who reach enlightenment or who practice the religion try to end suffering for others.
And themselves.
In themselves. So, don't you think in a way when you end suffering, you kind of feel like you don't live anymore? Like, isn't that a problem? Because don't you think that, like, those really intense feelings, like suffering and all that kind of stuff, like, makes you feel alive?
Yeah, the highs and the lows, the roller coaster ride of life. Isn't that the fun? Do we want to give all that up? Do we want to become walking vegetables? Not feeling or thinking anything? No. Now, thank you for bringing that up. I'm being a bit dramatic. But thank you for bringing that up. So what we could say is, what are some of the characteristics of an enlightened person? Do they have a life? Do enlightened people have lives? Or do they just sit around all day? Well, enlightened people do have lives. And if you read the story of the Buddha, he achieved his enlightenment at 35 and he died at 80. And for 45 years he traveled and talked and had a personality, and he had all those kind of things that people have. And then he died. So this is how I like to describe the characteristics of an enlightened person. Their intention, their mind, is always based in love and kindness. Their activity is always based in compassion. Their happiness and their success is dependent only on the success and happiness of others. And their mind is always in perfect balance, with no preference, not expecting it to be this way or that way. So those characteristics describe a perfect, enlightened human being. And yet they still have a personality, but they're not that personality. They still have to sleep and eat because they have a body, and they need medical care because they have a body. The only thing different is that they never will suffer again. Now, a lot of us don't really know what suffering is. I must admit, my life's pretty good. But if we were in Pakistan when the earthquake happened, and our village was crumbled, and all our friends were dead, and there we were sitting next to the house that used to be, and winter was coming, and we had no food, and this guy sort of walks up to you and says, I can help you end your suffering. I bet you go, oh yeah, please tell me, tell me. Well, how about if you were in Darfur right now, where people are starving to death, the war is going on, refugee camps everywhere, not enough to eat, friends and family dying every day, and there's nothing you can do about it. And someone came up to you and said, I can help you end your suffering. Please, talk to me. Now, sometimes I go up to a Peninsula High School, and, you know, suffering happens up there too. They lost the game, I know. But suffering is dependent on your situation. A lot of us don't have a lot of suffering in our life. We're lucky. We have transportation. We have a place to live. We have clothing. We have a nice school. We have good shoes. Life's okay. You know, so what I'm talking about is the person who is really suffering. And when they hear the message of the Buddha, they go, right on. Oh, I've been waiting for this. Thank you. When I go to hospitals and talk to people who are dying, they don't want to know about the Lakers. They could care less. They want to know, how can I die peacefully? How can I die and not suffer? Is that possible? How can I make the transition to die now so I can live again, according to Buddhism? So we're talking about the big suffering, but we're also talking about the little suffering. It's just, there's something about our life that's just not quite perfect. If only, I'm not sure what it is, I can't point at it and say this is it, but if only it was just a little different, my life would be perfect. So Buddhism and the practice of Buddhism is designed to make our life perfect, not by changing the outside, but by changing the inside. Question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So you were saying how a lot of our suffering is from wanting to change things, not accepting pain. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
But a lot of people who do suffer, and they, like the people who were involved in the entire earthquake in Pakistan, that didn't have anything to do with them, though. They didn't do anything to bring that upon themselves.
No, but are they going to be able to accept it the way it is? Or would they want it to be different? I bet you they wanted it to be different. I bet you they wish the earthquake didn't happen.
But isn't that different than having a goal? I don't know, it just seems different.
It can be confusing, because am I talking about having a goal? Do we just want to accept our life the way it is and have no goals at all and not be anything? Well, no, that's not what I'm talking about. But that's a great question, because it does get confusing at this level. The idea is to have goals, but to realize they are just that. They're just goals. They're just thoughts we're having right now about what I'd like to do tomorrow, which when tomorrow happens will be right now. Now, the words get in the way, I know. But I'm not saying don't have goals. I'm saying realize that goals are just mind-made. And our life is mind-made as well. That our sense doors, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, our mind, create this world through ego, through the process of self. And we write the story. And sometimes when we're doing really deep meditation, we just see things, and we just hear things, and we just smell things and taste things without writing any story. It's just simply sight and sound and smell and taste with no story, no value, no good or bad. Those are the building blocks of our life. Now, I'm not saying that life's a lot of fun just having sight and sound, because it's more fun to have sound helicopter, sound fire engine, sight beautiful flowers, than just to have sight. And that's the gift we've been given, the gift of ego, the gift of self. But we can transcend that to find the ultimate reality, and we can live in that as well. We can live in the relative and the ultimate. And the idea of an advanced meditator is to dance between the two. If I'm pulled over by a police officer going 80 miles an hour, and I say, "Officer, you know, this driver's license doesn't really represent me at all. I am all things and many things, interconnected and interdependent." And he might say, "Kusala, have you thought about counseling?" So sometimes we have to be the driver's license. We have to be the relative person who people think we are, or they get confused. If I told my mom, "Mom, I'm not really who you think I am," she'd go, "My poor son, what did Buddhism do to you?" So I need to be her son, and I need to be a good driver to stay alive, and I need to pay my taxes, but I always realize that's not who I ultimately am. Those are just the things I need to be to live in a very complicated social world. Yes?
I just had a kind of two-part question about the goal type thing.
Yeah. It's confusing, isn't it?
Yeah. So is goal kind of, is a goal like kind of being a relative ignorance kind of thing?
Yes.
So is achieving nirvana not a goal?
Ah, very good. If it's not good to have goals, is having the goal of nirvana even valid? Yeah. Well, the idea, how much time do we have? Are we getting? Okay. I'll speak quickly. The Buddha said, we're always in a constant state of becoming. We never become anything. In the book Siddhartha, what did the river become? Well, we think the river became the ocean, maybe. But the river never becomes anything. It's always in a state of constant state of becoming. So our life is the same way. When you graduate from this school, when is the exact moment you will be a graduate? Or is it just a continuing process of now going on to UCLA? And then you graduate from there. And then you might want a PhD and you graduate from there. And then you get a job. And then you get promotions. And then your whole life was like, but you never really stopped. And that was it. And nothing else happened. It was always in a constant state of becoming. So as a Buddhist, I had nirvana as my goal. That's what Buddha said. We can achieve nirvana. And as I started to meditate and study and practice, I realized that having the goal prevented me from achieving it. Because the goal is an illusion. The most important thing is not the goal, but the process of achieving the goal. So if you ever decide to become a volunteer, don't become a volunteer because you want to become a volunteer. Become a volunteer because you want to do volunteer work.
Okay, so you could actually think of it as already being born enlightened.
Already existing. Already. Yes. Well, I was talking to one of the other teachers before I came in here. He was doing archery. I do archery. There was a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, written by a German fellow. And in this book, he says, the arrow and the target are already connected. Wouldn't that be cool if you just went and it found the target? That's the whole idea. So we are already connected to nirvana. It's just our lust, greed, hatred, and delusion prevent us from seeing that connection. Is that helpful? Okay. We got a couple more minutes? Okay. One thing I didn't get a chance to do in the other class, but I'd like to do it now because I've been talking about suffering, and you guys have had some of the best questions I've had all day today. I brought my blues harmonica. And sometimes I like to play my harmonica because it makes me feel better. And sometimes I like to play my harmonica because it makes everybody else feel better. Because all I've been talking about is suffering, getting old, getting sick and dying. And how boring and depressing is that? So here's a little blues. What else would a Buddhist play? Here we go. Thank you all for listening to what I had to say today. Well, that's it. That was my presentation at Chadwick School yesterday to the second class I spoke to, and they were studying the book Siddhartha. Hope you found it interesting. Hope you found it useful. If you'd like to know more about me, please visit my website, kusala.info, kusala.info. My email address is kusala@urbandharma.org. And I'll get back to you just as soon as I can. Like hearing from you. Like to know if you find these podcasts interesting and if they're helpful as well. I also have an email newsletter I send out twice a month, and you can sign up at urbandharma.org. So until next time, until the next podcast, be happy, be peaceful, and most of all, be free from suffering.